From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Germany played host this week to the 11th Petersburg Climate Dialogue. At least 30 senior climate ministers from around the globe participated, with this year's dialogue being held via video conference. This was Germany's federal chancellor, Angela Merkel.
Let me tell you yet again, there's going to be a very difficult debate over distribution. If we look at the severe harm that has been caused by the corona crisis to our economies all over the world, we also have to encourage each other not to forget climate protection, and not to sort of try to reduce climate protection in order to save money, but to, on the contrary, enhance it, not only think of our national situation, but that we also fulfill our international commitments and pursue rigorously our international commitments so that we have a global success in climate protection. Living up to the commitments of our joint agreement, each and everyone in the international community needs to give a contribution. That is to say, we need to turn our backs on fossil fuels, and we have to embrace renewables, and we also have to embrace saving energy. And I believe that market economic incentives, through, for example, a CO2 pricing, is absolutely essential. It would be highly desirable to see as many countries as possible joining up, because CO2 pricing is the most efficient way to reduce emissions. And if as many countries as possible participate, this prevents a possible distortion to competition when we coordinate our CO2 pricing scheme. In this way, as I said, this prevents distortion. Of course, it's also important for investors to see that making investment in these areas in modern technology makes commercial sense, and that in particular with regard to renewables. Wind and sun as energy sources are there all over the world. Tapping their potential, however, often fails because of the high cost of capital. That means our financial markets have to provide capital at favorable conditions for climate-friendly investments, and here as many stakeholders ought to work together, states, development banks, but also the private finance sector. Always thinking of both the environment and the economy, this is what we need to do, and particularly in particular when we deal with our ecosystems and biodiversity. We are changing, as no other generation before us, our natural habitat. And that obviously has its grave impact on the biodiversity, and that has in turn also its effect and impact on humankind itself. Just one example. Scientists have told us that over the past decade, 60% of all infectious diseases have been transferred from animals to human beings, and this is in particular due to the increased use of hitherto undisturbed habitats and the fact that we're getting closer and closer to wild animals. So there's no other option but to make progress in the international protection of biodiversity and the forests. A new framework on the protection of biodiversity has to be in place by next year, when we all participate in the 15th UN conference on the implementation of biodiversity, of the biodiversity convention. Ladies and gentlemen, the 17 SDGs of Agenda 2030, also health and climate protection, make it very clear that sustainable development cannot be pursued by sacrificing individual goals, but that we always have to think and act with them at the back of our minds in concert. Just as we can only fulfill all of the SDGs in Agenda 2030, if we are both determined and consistent in our national policies and act together internationally. And I would like to ask all of you for your support, and I hope and trust that a very clear message is sent from this climate dialogue that biodiversity and climate protection, particularly at this time of a pandemic, are of supreme importance. And I thank all of you for your contribution, and thank you for allowing me to participate.
Chancellor Merkel's comments were followed by these comments from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Madam Chancellor, dear Angela Merkel, ministers, dear friends. COVID-19 has put the lives of billions of people around the globe in turmoil, inflicting grave suffering and destabilizing the global economy. It has exposed the fragility of our societies and economies to shocks, and it has laid bare deep inequalities that threaten the achievement of the Sustainable Development Goals. The only answer is brave, visionary, and collaborative leadership. And the same leadership is needed to address the looming existential threat of climate disruption. Last year was the second hottest year on record, part of the hottest decade in recorded history. Delayed climate action will cost us vastly more cash, vastly more each year in terms of lost lives and livelihoods, crippled businesses, and damaged economies. The highest cost is the cost of doing nothing. We must urgently put in place measures to strengthen resilience and cut greenhouse gas emissions to limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees. Technology is on our side. So increasingly is public opinion, especially the voice of young people. Many cities and businesses are taking action, but we still lack the necessary political will in many parts of the world. That is why I continue to advocate for significantly more ambition on mitigation, adaptation, and financing. On mitigation, we need all countries to commit to carbon neutrality by 2050. On adaptation, we need to support those countries least responsible for climate change, but most vulnerable to its impact. They need to build resilience to protect their populations. And for that, we need adequate financing, beginning with the promised mobilization of $100 billion a year for mitigation and adaptation efforts in developing countries. As we plan our recovery from the coronavirus pandemic, we have a profound opportunity to steer our world in a more sustainable and inclusive path, a path that tackles climate change, protects the environment, reverses biodiversity loss, and ensures the long-term health and security of humankind. By making the transition to a low-carbon, climate-resilient growth, we can create a world that is clean, green, safe, just, and more prosperous for all. I am proposing 6 climate-related actions to shape the recovery. First, as we spend trillions to recover from COVID-19, we must deliver new jobs and businesses through a clean, green, and just transition. Investments must accelerate the decarbonization of all aspects of our economy. Second, where taxpayers' money is needed to rescue businesses, it must be creating green jobs and sustainable and inclusive growth. It must not be bailing out outdated, polluting, carbon-intensive industries. Third, fiscal firepower must shift economies from gray to green, making societies and people more resilient through a transition that is fair to all and leaves no one behind. Fourth, looking forward, public funds should invest in the future by flowing to sustainable sectors and projects that help the environment and climate. Fossil fuel subsidies must end, carbon must have a price, and polluters must pay for their pollution. Fifth, the global financial system, when it shapes policy and infrastructure, must take risks and opportunities related to climate into account. Investors cannot continue to ignore the price our planet pays for unsustainable growth. And sixth, to resolve both emergencies, we must work together in an international community. Like the coronavirus, greenhouse gases respect no boundaries. Isolation is a trap. No country can succeed alone. We already have a common framework for action, the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development and the Paris Agreement on Climate Change. To that end, I'm asking all countries to prepare enhanced national climate action plans or national determined contributions and strategies to reach net zero emissions by 2050. There are some signs of important progress. Some countries, including Chile, the current COP president, have already submitted enhanced NDCs, and a further 114 countries have announced they will do so. 121 countries have committed to achieving carbon neutrality by 2050. I encourage the European Union to continue showing global leadership by presenting by the end of the year a national determined contribution in line with its commitment to become the first climate neutral continent by 2050. And I congratulate Chancellor Angela Merkel for her leadership and their determination. And I'm sure the incoming COP president, the UK, will present an ambitious quality NDC in line with his nation's strategy to get to carbon neutrality by 2050. Just last week, the smallest and most vulnerable members of our international community, the small island nations, recommitted to climate ambition even in the midst of the COVID-19 crisis. Their leadership should serve as an inspiration for all. And we cannot allow the heavy and rising debt burden of these and other developing countries to serve as a barrier to their ambition. But the key to tackling the climate crisis is the big emitters. Let us not forget that the G20 countries collectively account for more than 80% of global emissions and over 85% of the global economy. All of them must also commit to carbon neutrality by 2050. The Paris Agreement was largely made possible by the engagement of the United States and China. Without the contribution of the big emitters, all efforts risk to be doomed. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, they say it's darkest just before the dawn. These are dark days, but they are not without hope. We have a rare and short window of opportunity to rebuild our world for the better. Let us use the pandemic recovery to provide a foundation for a safe, healthy, inclusive, and more resilient world for all people. And I thank you.
While the UN Secretary General was in virtual attendance at the climate dialogue, his spokesperson, Stéphane Dujarric, held a virtual press conference to update Secretary Guterres's other activities.
This morning, during a meeting organized by the European Commission with the G5 Sahel countries, the Deputy Secretary General, Mina Mohamed, said, as we face this global human crisis, keeping the Sahel high on the international agenda is of the utmost importance. While the virus has put a pause on the world, she added, it has certainly not put a pause on terrorism, poverty, and climate change. She welcomed the renewed commitment of the heads of state of the G5 Sahel and the European partners to join forces to counter terrorism, curb organized crime, and tackle the root causes of instability. The political, social, and economic impacts of the coronavirus have been exacerbating pressure on the G5 Sahel countries, already under extreme stress. In Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, 4 million people face extreme hunger, a figure that is expected to reach 5.5 million people by August. In Mali, for example, COVID-19 has already affected agriculture and led to a significant rise in prices, seriously affecting food security. The Deputy Secretary General said that COVID-19 threatens to swallow hard-won development gains. In this context, she reiterated the importance of partnership and called on all partners to enhance coordination and exchange information and mutual support. Her full remarks are also online. And following an initiative by Jordan, 167 member states and permanent observers have issued a statement of solidarity and appreciation to the city of New York in the midst of the COVID-19 crisis. New York City, the statement says, has been the home that has welcomed and nurtured collective action against global challenges. It is in New York City that the headquarters of the United Nations stands as a collective voice for peace, prosperity, and solidarity. We are fully confident that New York will overcome this crisis, the statement says. New Yorkers will triumph over this challenge and will emerge stronger and more resilient. The member states and permanent observers saluted the dedication and courage of all New Yorkers. We know that New Yorkers will win over this vicious enemy, they said. The Secretary General will be issuing this letter as an official document of the United Nations and is, of course, fully supportive not only of this initiative, but our wonderful host city. And a new analysis issued today by the UN Population Fund and its partners pointed out that the economic and physical disruptions caused by COVID-19 could have vast consequences for the rights and health of women and girls. The research shows that significant levels of lockdown-related disruptions over 6 months could leave 47 million women in 114 low- and middle-income countries unable to use modern contraceptives. This could lead to a projected 7 million additional unintended pregnancies. 6 months of lockdown could also result in an additional 31 million cases of gender-based violence. The UN Population Fund added that the pandemic is expected to cause significant delays in programs to end female genital mutilation and child marriage. Due to these disruptions, 2 million more cases of FGM and 13 million more child marriages may occur over the next decade. And the Joint UN Program on HIV/AIDS, UNAIDS, and MPACT, Global Action for Gay Men's Health and Rights, are extremely concerned that lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersex people are being singled out, blamed, abused, incarcerated, and stigmatized as vectors of disease during this pandemic. Winnie Bianyema, the executive director of UNAIDS, said that all people, regardless of their sexual orientation, gender identity, or gender expression, are entitled to the right to health, safety, and security without exception. She added that respect and dignity are needed more now than ever before. And today is the World Day for Safety and Health at Work. This year, not surprisingly, it focuses on addressing the outbreak of infectious diseases at work, in particular during the current pandemic. We note that governments, employers, workers, and their organizations face enormous challenges as they try to combat pandemic and protect safety and health at work. Beyond the immediate crisis, they're also concerned about resuming activity in a manner that sustains progress made in suppressing the transmission. For its part, the International Labor Organization warns that without adequate safeguards for returning workers, there could be a second wave of the virus. And a few updates to share with you from the country level. In Samoa, where there have been no confirmed cases of COVID-19, the pandemic has already impacted the economy as of the country, as well as others in the South Pacific. The resident coordinator there, Simona Marinescu, is leading the UN team's response, which also covers three territories. The UN team, including UNDP, the UN Population Fund, the UN Children's Fund, and the World Health Organization, are providing technical assistance to the health sector in procuring critical medical supplies and personal protective equipment. On the socioeconomic front, together with the government, the UN is working on a food bank for more than 4,000 households until the economy has stabilized. The UN team is also allocating some existing funds from European Union under the EU-UN Spotlight Initiative to address the impacts of the virus on violence against women in their homes. And in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where just like everywhere else, ensuring that children continue to learn despite school closures is a challenge. Our colleagues in peacekeeping mission report that Radio Kapi, the radio station operated by the peacekeeping mission, is the first media outlet in the country to provide education through radio. Okapi Ecole was launched this past Sunday in partnership with the Ministry of Education and the UN Children's Fund. It aims to provide 14 broadcast hours every week of schooling to the 22 million children currently at home because their schools are closed. This radio programming will run for the next 6 months. It focuses on primary education and stems from a call for proposals from the Ministry of Education to media in the DRC. And the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan says it documented a total of 533 civilians killed and 760 injured in Afghanistan during the first 3 months of this year. According to a UN report released yesterday, the numbers include 150 children who were killed due to fighting in the country. The report tracks a disturbing increase in violence during March, when it was hoped that the government of Afghanistan and the Taliban would commence peace negotiations. It also highlights the urgent need for all parties to the conflict to do more to protect civilians from harm, especially in the view of looming threat posed by all Afghans by the virus. Despite increasing levels of violence in March, the overall number of civilian casualties in the first quarter of 2020 represents a 29% decrease in comparison with the first quarter of 2019 and the lowest figure for a quarter since 2012. And from Myanmar, our humanitarian colleagues there tell us that the continued conflict between the Myanmar Armed Forces and the Arakan Army in Rakhine State and in south of Chin State have led to increased civilian casualties and forced people to flee their homes in recent weeks. Last week alone, more than 30 civilians, including children, were reportedly killed or injured by shelling and small arms fire. You'll remember that on April 20th, a WHO staff member was killed and a government official injured in Rakhine while supporting the response to the virus. Myanmar is now facing the very real threat of the disease. The humanitarian coordinator there, Ola Almgren, has highlighted how continued conflict is also a major impediment in the fight against the pandemic. The UN is working closely to support national prevention and response efforts. And turning to Colombia, the Secretary General regrets the announcement made by the National Liberation Army, known as ELN in Spanish, that it will not extend its unilateral ceasefire past the end of April after several weeks in which it was having a positive effect. An extension would have brought hope and a message of peace to conflict-affected communities and beyond, facilitating the pandemic response in light with the Secretary General's call. We continue to urge armed groups in Colombia to cease all violence. Communities urgently need relief assistance, unimpeded by the risk of hostilities and violence. And at that this time, the country's people need to be able to concentrate on their efforts to fight the pandemic. And I was asked about the situation in southern Yemen yesterday, and I have the following to say. The Secretary General is following with concern developments on the ground in southern Yemen. He urges all relevant stakeholders to exercise maximum restraint and refrain from any action that would further escalate the situation. He calls on all to engage in an inclusive dialogue to resolve their differences and address the legitimate concern of all Yemenis, including those of southern groups. He further calls on them to implement the Riyadh Agreement, as well as concentrate efforts to counter the spread of COVID-19 and to respond to the flooding that has impacted thousands of Yemenis. The Secretary General reaffirms the need to preserve the integrity of the Yemeni institutions and emphasizes that conflict in Yemen can only be resolved through negotiated political settlement. I also want to clarify something that the special coordinator for the Middle East peace process, Nikolai Mladenov, said in his remarks to Security Council members last week on the 23rd of April, when he said that, quote, 34 Palestinian-owned structures in Area C were demolished during the reporting period, that is from the 21st of March to the 22nd of April. I want to specify that there were no structures demolished in East Jerusalem during the reporting period. And due to the COVID-19 crisis, Israeli authorities did not demolish any inhabited structures after March 26th. The briefing makes clear that while the temporary halt to home demolitions was welcome, the demolitions of unhabited structures continued, and the special coordinator called for these to stop. And virtually back here, this morning, the Security Council held an open video conference on the UN peacekeeping mission in Abyei. Briefing council members was the Undersecretary General for Peace Operations, Jean-Pierre Lacroix. He said that despite the improving relations between Sudan and South Sudan, it remains very unlikely that progress will be made in determining the final status of the Abyei area in the short and medium to medium term. He said that at the local level, the security situation in the Abyei area remains volatile, with the tensions between the Ngok Dinka and the Misiraya communities, an increase in criminality, and the presence of armed elements in the mission's area of responsibility. Mr. Lacroix said that UN troops have been subject to attacks by armed elements, pointing to an incident on the 24th when UN forces were fired upon by an armed Misiraya herdsman in Nainai. In a separate incident on the same day in the same area, three members of the Misiraya community attacked the temporary operating base at Alal, in which peacekeepers repelled that attack. Regarding COVID-19, Mr. Lacroix said the UN mission is working to encourage hand washing and social distancing, as well as to decongest detention centers and set up screening sites in Abyei. He requested that the council extend the mission's mandate for a further 6 months. And finally, I'm delighted to announce that our friends from Andorra have paid their balance of in full of the 2020 regular budget, which takes us up to 86 fully paid up member states. And on this note, I will now turn to you to perform. I need my glasses, and let's see what is coming in from Florencia. James Bays. James, I can't hear you. All right. I'm going to go in the meantime. Sylviane, did you have a question? If you want to turn on your microphone.
Me?
Yes, I can hear you.
You hear me? Yes, thank you, Stefan. This is a question on Lebanon. Lebanon's economic protest turned violent with protesters blocking off road despite the COVID-19 lockdown across Lebanon for the second consecutive days to denounce the country's economy near collapse. Any comment from the SG to the Lebanese leader and protester and on the situation in Lebanon, please?
Sure. I mean, as always, we urge protesters to exercise their right to protest peacefully and security personnel to protect peaceful protests and to act proportionally in maintaining law and order. The UN is working closely with the government to respond to the challenges posed by the current pandemic, and we remain committed to helping Lebanon address the ongoing social and economic challenges. And we look forward to the government's economic rescue plan in that regard. James,
another
are you
question,
back on?
Another question. Yeah, another question on UNIFIL. On UNIFIL, yeah. The COVID regarding COVID-19. What's the situation in the UNIFIL area, please?
Well, I know that our colleagues in UNIFIL, the various, have been working with the local population, distributing aid, whether it's personal protective device, and being supportive of the government's efforts in the south to help stem the growth of the pandemic. Abdelhamid.
Thank you, Stefan. I'll start with Libya, and because Haftar, General Haftar, last night, he designated himself as the supreme leader of Libya, and he called for completely abolishing the Libyan political agreement signed in Sakhira. So he said, it is behind us, it's null and void. This major development, there was a statement from the Russian Foreign Ministry and from the US, why there is no specific statement that addresses this development that Haftar took last night. That's one question. Yeah, please.
Our position is unchanged, and I think I've just answered it in response to Edie, that it's very clear that for us, the Libyan political agreement, the institutions that come out of this agreement remain the sole internationally recognized framework of governments in Libya. And that's in line with Security Council resolutions, which have been often repeated. So that's our position. I would let all of you do the compare and contrast, but our position is very clear. What is your second question, Abdelhamid?
Okay. My second question, in Saudi Arabia, a human rights activist called Abdullah Al-Hamid died in his prison for medical negligence, and even Kalamar, Ms. Agnes Kalamar, issued a tweet on that, and there was so much talk about this incident. Do you follow what's going on in the Saudi jails? Did you take note of the death of this human rights activist, Abdullah Al-Hamid?
I will take a look. I would also maybe advise you to talk to our human rights colleagues, but let me see if I can get you anything on that.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.